The bands gathered in May on the Red River, just west of the reservation boundary, near present-day Texola, where I-40 intersects the Texas-Oklahoma border. Though they did worship the sun, and usually blew the first puff of sacred smoke in its direction, they were true animists. Power and magic was not concentrated in one or two places, such as a great spirit, but diffused throughout the universe. Power could reside in wolves and trees and rock bluffs as much as in the sun. But Comanches were intensely practical people. They were happy to try anything that worked, and Issa Tai was a persuasive man. So they dispensed with the military societies, the fetish dolls, the trained priests, the medicine bundles, the rite of warriors piercing their breast tendons with thongs and hanging from the lodge pole, and other traditions considered essential by other tribes. They built a medicine lodge of poles and brush and acted out sham battles and sham buffalo hunts. They danced a simplified, practical sun dance, and they held a massive party with a good deal of whiskey and feasting and all-night drum playing. They gloried in believing again in the power of Comanches. In the end, perhaps half of the tribe agreed to follow Quanah and Issa Tai. The exact number or percentage is unknown. The Panaticas, by now quite tame and even engaged in some farming, left for the reservation. They were frightened by such talk. Most of the Nekonis left too, under their chief Horseback, and many of the Yamparicas went with them. They did so under threat. Quanah's people said they would kill their horses and strand them afoot if they did not go along. Some of the defectors were even threatened with personal violence. The Yamparica chief Quitzquip reported back to Indian agent J.M. Hayworth that by night, the Comanches were being whipped into a chauvinistic frenzy with whiskey, drumming, dancing, and war talk, only to lapse into confusion and indecision, and presumably hangovers, the next morning. "They have a great many hearts," he told Hayworth. "They make up their minds at night, for one thing, and get up in the morning entirely changed." At their war councils, Quanah and Issa Tai promoted their idea of a revenge raid in Texas, starting with the traitor Tonkawas and moving on to a war on the settlements. But the tribal elders had other ideas and overruled the two young men. Quanah later remembered it this way. They said, "You pretty good fighter, Quanah, but you not know everything. We think you take pipe first against the white buffalo hunters. You kill white men and make your heart feel good. After that, you come back and take all young men and go Texas warpath." Issa Tai make big talk that time. He said, "God tell me we going to kill lots of white men. I stop the bullets in gun. Bullets not penetrate shirts. We kill them just like old women." So the first target would be the buffalo hunters at adobe walls. Then the full fury of the tribe would fall upon the hated Texans and their traitorous allies, the Tonks. Armed with their powerful idea, Quanah and Issa Tai now visited the camps of the Kiowas, Cheyennes, and Arapahoes to recruit warriors for the attack on the Hyde Men. They had little success with the Kiowas, where, according to one of them, the elders were afraid of that pipe. Only a few of the tribe agreed to go. They had better luck with the Cheyennes, many of whom were enthusiastic about the expedition, especially with the protection of Issa Tai's medicine. The Arapahoes liked the idea, but hedged. Powderface, their main chief, was deeply committed to the white man's road. Only 22 of them agreed to go, under the young upstart chief Yellow Horse. The force of 250 warriors was thus composed mainly of Comanches and Cheyennes. They were clear on three things: that the attack would be made on the buffalo camp 40 miles to the west, that it would be made under Issa Tai's protective magic, and that it would be led by the young Quanah, who had impressed everyone with his burning passion and his singleness of purpose. The raid on the trading post should have been an outright slaughter. The night was warm and sultry, and most of the people at the post, 28 men and one woman, scattered among two stores and a saloon, were sleeping outdoors. There was no hotel, no rooms for rent. Those who were under roofs were in buildings whose doors were wide open. Isatai knew this from a scouting party he had sent out, and had confidently promised his men that they would sweep down on the Taibos and club them to death in their sleep. It was a good plan, in principle anyway. In the early morning hours of June 26, 1874, the Indians under Quanah's command massed on a high bluff beside the Canadian River. They waited. Among them was the Messiah, Isatai, stark naked except for a cap of sage stems and painted completely yellow, as was his horse. Yellow meant invulnerable. Most of the other braves and their horses were painted yellow too, along with other colors. They all believed, or they would not have been there, that Isatai had true puha, that they would be immune to the white man's bullets. After all, a man who could ascend into the sky and who could burp up a load of cartridges would have little trouble with a small band of the hated buffalo men. The assembled Comanches, Cheyennes, Kiowas, and Arapahoes believed that this was a moment of destiny and that their redemption was at hand. But the massacre of sleeping Taibos never happened. That was because the owner of the saloon, a transplanted Pennsylvanian by way of Dodge City named James Hanrahan, fired his gun in the middle of the night, waking many of the hunters, skinners, merchants, and drovers. He told his guests, and they apparently believed him, that the loud noise they had heard had been made by the cracking of the ridgepole, the main beam holding up the sod roof of the saloon. Such an event would mean death, injury, or at the very least extreme inconvenience for the people underneath it. Fully awake now, the men then pitched in and spent the rest of the night replacing the ridgepole. In fact, the ridgepole was fine. Hanrahan had invented the story about the roof falling in because he had been informed several days before that the Indian attack was coming and had not wanted to hurt his business, and thus hadn't told anyone. When the men had finished their task, Hanrahan, refusing to come clean about the attack, but afraid to let anyone go back to sleep, offered them free drinks at 4 a.m. Thus, many of them were wide awake when the Indian war party swept down from the bluff just before dawn on June 27th. The Indians drove down into the valley with a fury. Quanah recalled later that the horses were moving at a gallop, throwing dust high in the air, and that some of them tripped on the prairie dog holes, which sent men in feathered headdresses and horses rolling over and over in the semi-darkness. At the settlement, they crowded around the buildings, firing their carbines at windows and doors. Inside, the buffalo men barricaded themselves as best they could, piled up sacks of grain, and found that they were fairly well protected behind 2-foot walls of sod. Sod that would not burn, either, which would have offered the Indians an easy victory. The attackers flattened themselves against the walls. Quanah backed his horse into one of the doors, trying unsuccessfully to break it down, and later climbed up on the roof of one of the buildings to shoot down at the occupants. At one point, he picked up a wounded comrade from the ground while seated on his horse, a feat of strength that astounded the men inside the buildings. In the early minutes of the fight, both sides were using six-shooters. For the white men inside, the fury of the attack was terrifying. The buildings were full of smoke. People were shouting and screaming. The air was full of singing lead. Billy Dixon recalled that, at times, the bullets poured in like hail and made us hug the sod walls like gophers when an owl is swooping past. This is Quanah's own account, filtered through the memory of his friend J.A. Dixon. "We at once surrounded the place and began to fire on it. The hunters got in the houses and shot through the cracks and holes in the wall. Fight lasted about 2 hours. We tried to storm the place several times, but the hunters shot so well, we would have to retreat. At one time, I picked up 5 braves, and we crawled along a little ravine to their corral, which was only a few yards from the house. Then we picked our chance and made a run for the house before they could shoot us, and we tried to break the door in, but it was too strong, and being afraid to stay long, we went back the way we had come." 3 white men had been killed in the early moments of the raid, but the others had managed to hold the Indians off. The flanking fire from the saloon protected the people in the two mercantile buildings, most of whom had been asleep. The whites learned that by poking holes in the sod, they could create gun ports for themselves and thus drive back the Indians from the other side of the wall. The Hyde men, moreover, were an unusually tough bunch, even by plain standards. In addition to various hunters, skinners, and wagon drivers, they included Billy Dixon, a famous buffalo hunter who would win a Congressional Medal of Honor later that year fighting Indians, William Barkley Bat Masterson, a gambler and gunman who later became legendary as the sheriff of Dodge City, Dutch Henry Bourne, later the most feared of the professional horse thieves on the Great Plains, and James Bermuda Carlyle, later killed when a posse in White Oaks, New Mexico, tried to arrest Billy the Kid and his gang. The Indians were driven back. They discovered that, even though many among their ranks had repeating lever-action rifles, they were yet again at an enormous disadvantage in firepower. Inside those buildings were not just hardened and determined men with considerable experience of violence, cocooned inside thick walls of mud and grass. They also had a virtual arsenal of ammunition and weaponry at their disposal, most notably the brand-new Sharps Big 50s, rifles of astonishing power, range, and accuracy that had made the wholesale slaughter of the buffalo possible in the first place. The merchants had whole cases of brand-new Sharps rifles, plus at least 11,000 rounds of ammunition. The Big 50s were single-shot weapons with octagonal 34-inch barrels that used huge cartridges, 50-caliber 600-grain bullets driven by 125 grains of black powder. They were so powerful that they could knock down a 2,000-pound buffalo at 1,000 yards. In the hands of the buffalo hunters, they were horrifically effective against horses and human beings. The rifles' ranges were far longer than the Indians' carbines could possibly reach. By 10 o'clock, the Indians had retreated from the booming buffalo guns. Quanah, who after heroically fighting at close quarters had also fallen back, had his horse shot out from under him at 500 yards. He took shelter behind a buffalo carcass, where he was hit by a bullet that ricocheted off a powder horn around his neck and lodged between his shoulder blade and neck. The wound was not serious. Astonished at the range and accuracy of the guns, the Indians retreated yet farther, only to learn that they had still not gone far enough. A group of them had met to plan strategy at a distance of roughly 3/4 of a mile from the trading post. Undeterred, the hunters began to pick them off one by one. A Comanche named Cohaya, who was among them, recalled that he was standing with his friends trying to figure out how to rescue their dead, when suddenly and without warning, one of the warriors fell from his horse dead. They found a bullet hole in his head. The wind had shifted, and they had not even heard the sound of a rifle shot. In the distance, Isatai sat on his horse, naked and bright ochre, watching the epic failure of his medicine. Nothing he had predicted had come true. The men who were supposed to be slaughtered in their sleep were now dropping Indians on the field like shotgunned mallards. The Cheyennes were angry at him. One of them struck Isatai in the face with his riding quirt. Another, the father of a young warrior who had been killed, demanded to know why, if the Messiah were immune to bullets, he did not go recover the young man's body. As if to emphasize Isatai's powerlessness, the man on the horse next to him was shot dead. Then Isatai's own horse was shot out from under him. His magic may have failed, but the magic of the Big 50s worked just fine. Killing people 3/4 of a mile away was, by all objective precedent, godlike. Isatai's excuse was that the Cheyennes had killed and skinned a skunk the day before the battle, and thus queered his medicine. His people did not really believe him. The effect on the Indians was devastating. It was not so much the carnage, 15 were killed that day, and many more wounded, as the shocking failure of Isatai's medicine. That was the first great demoralizing blow. The second was the wounding of Quanah, who was rescued by his people and brought back out of range of the buffalo guns. As we have seen, the killing or wounding of the leader was almost invariably a signal for retreat. By 4 o'clock, the Indians had given up. The whites emerged from their buildings and collected trinkets and souvenirs. Though the Indians remained nearby for the next several days, taking occasional shots at the sod walls of the trading post, they never attacked again. The battle was over. On the third day, Billy Dixon made what became the most famous single shot in the history of the West. A party of about 15 Indians had appeared at the edge of the bluff at a distance of probably 1,500 yards, or almost a mile. As Dixon recalled, "Some of the boys suggested that I try the big 50 on them. I took careful aim and pulled the trigger. We saw an Indian fall from his horse." He was the last casualty of what would become famous in frontier history as the Second Battle of Adobe Walls, where a handful of doughty white men held off a buzzing horde of Indians that had been variously estimated at 700 to 1,000, though 250 is closer to the truth. Astonished and terrified, the rest of the Indians fled. The rest was anticlimax. The whites, strengthened by the arrival of more than 70 hunters who were now afraid to be alone on the plains, eventually decided it was safe to go about their business. After burying their 4 dead comrades, one died accidentally, and the scalped Newfoundland dog that had died with the drovers, the whites beheaded the dead Indians and stuck their heads on stakes outside the walls. They placed the 13 headless bodies on buffalo hides and dragged them away along with the dead horses. The Indians had killed them all, which had begun to reek. Meanwhile, the Indians drifted off, furious, helpless. Once again, bad medicine had been their fatal weakness. They could not help themselves. Reverse the roles to see what might have happened. The whites would have surrounded the buildings and kept up the attack. They would have come by night and caved in the walls. They would have accepted far greater losses to achieve the objective than Indians ever would. Indians never understood the concept of seizing and holding a small piece of real estate or of calculating the grim cost-benefit ratio of a siege. Failing all this, the white men would have simply starved the Indians out, waiting patiently for them to get so thirsty they would have to choose between dying and fighting. Though the hide men had escaped Quanah's army with their skins intact, the rest of the frontier wasn't so lucky. After their failure at Adobe Walls, the enraged warriors formed smaller groups and struck blindly in all directions at western settlements from Colorado to Texas. Kiowas under Lone Wolf crossed the border into Texas. Cheyennes and Comanches under Quanah struck first to the east, driving the herd of buffalo hunters' horses and destroying a wagon train in the Indian Territory, then attacking settlements in Texas. Little is known of these raids. Some said Quanah ventured as far north as southern Colorado. He himself later allowed only that, following Adobe Walls, "I take all men, go warpath to Texas." Attacks were made as far north as Medicine Lodge in Kansas. The entire frontier was forced to fort up. Stages were attacked. Stations were burned. Parties of hide men were tortured and killed. Men were staked out on the prairie, and women raped and murdered in terrible ways. The Indian outbreak that swept the southern plains that summer killed an estimated 190 white people and wounded many more. Its effects were immediate. Hide hunting stopped altogether. Hunters and settlers, and anyone on the edge of the frontier, fled to the protection of the federal forts. Adobe Walls may have failed, but the summer raids accomplished exactly what Isatai and Quanah had wanted: massive revenge against the white people that caused panic and terror for 1,000 miles. Amid their feelings of rage and frustration, the summer killing must have given them satisfaction. It represented justice to them, the evening of old scores. Unfortunately for Quanah and Lone Wolf and the others killing white men that summer, their predations also exhausted the last of the white man's patience and ruined forever the arguments of the peace advocates and pro-Indian humanitarians. On July 26th, Grant gave Sherman permission to put the agencies and reservations under military control, thus ending 5 years of the failed peace policy. On the same day, Lieutenant Colonel John W. "Blackjack" Davidson, the commander at Fort Sill, ordered all friendly Indians to register and enroll at the agencies by August 3rd and to report for a daily roll call. Grant ordered the Army to move immediately and in force. All restrictions were lifted on movements of the Army. They were at liberty to pursue the Indians to the front porch of the agency at Fort Sill, if necessary, and kill them there. There would be no safe harbor on the reservation, no forgiveness for those who stayed out. The Bluecoats were now, as the uber warrior Grant put it simply and bluntly, to subdue all Indians who offered resistance to constituted authority. The plan, for which an enormous amount of Army firepower would be brought to bear, was to hunt them all down.